Or did they?
Call the meeting to order. Representative Slocum will move the minutes of the 3-2 March 2nd meeting. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Next up is House File 2781. Welcome back, Representative Overmiller. The you came through Representative Davney's committee. I know he's on his way down. The chair will move the division report. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. The chair will then move House File 2781. As amended in division, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. It's my understanding you have an amendment. Is that right, Representative Overmiller?
I do, Mr. Chair, and actually there's two amendments. The first is the A-10-2243 amendment. It should be in your packets. The other one's an oral amendment, which I'm happy to move.
That was my understanding. There were two amendments. I only saw the one, so the second one is oral, and the first one is an author's amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, the chair will move the A-10-2243 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. And then secondly, is also an author's amendment that is of an oral variety?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Where is that?
It goes on line 4.3. The fee numbers that are listed there, we inadvertently lowered to, when we balanced out the numbers here, those numbers actually were lowered too much in the last committee when we amended it, so I apologize for that. But in 4.3, the 80 should go to 90. The 160 goes to 180, and the 240 goes to 270. And before anyone gets concerned about us raising the business one, that's actually still lower than it was originally, so we're still okay.
All right. So then the oral amendment is on line 4.3. Delete the number $80 and replace with $90. Delete the number $160 and replace with $180. And delete the figure $240 and replace with $270. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Chair, I'll move that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Overmuller, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that the Department of Labor has been working on, and I really appreciate the hard work that they've done to really put into to place some transparency and efficiency in our licensing system for contractors. The bill essentially collects all of various contractor license provisions in law and puts them into one section so they're easy to find, easy for people to know what's going on. It treats similarly situated contractors similarly. So if you're a master's level experience in one trade, your fees are about the same as they are. Their fees will be the same as someone who's a master level trade in a different trade. And so it helps kind of tie things out so things are transparent and fair in that regard. And it also makes sure that the fees we collect related to services that Dolly provides are related to the cost. So there's specific costs for some licenses that have continuing education, and we actually tie up a specific fee to the continuing education that's consistent across the board for each of those trades that have that type of a work. So it's kind of a smart reform bill that kind of takes all of the fees that Dolly had, was $5.2 million in 2009, but the fees were not tied to kind of what you were. If you were high pressure piping folks, you had a much bigger fee than you would otherwise have under this bill. Some fees went up, some fees went down. Overall, everybody's fees went down generally. Or I shouldn't say more people went down than up, I guess is what I should say on that front. But the long and the short of it is we took the same $5 million, we spread it out equally and fairly into levels that make sense, and it's kind of a good, I think, good policy bill, and I'm happy to stand for questions. Mr. Jacobs here as well if there's any questions from you.
Thank you, Representative Overmuller. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Overmuller, on the continuing education, are there any new testing requirements?
Careful. Representative Overmuller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, my understanding is there would be no new ones, just simply the changing the fee to accommodate the actual cost of performing those services that the Dolly does.
Sounds like a pretty good bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Happy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Obermuller, looking at your amendment on page 37, having had a charter boat captain's license, I'm pretty sure I know this, but just to double check, that does not apply to fishing guides. Is that the case?
Representative Obermuller.
Mr. Jacobs is going to answer that one. Thank you.
He was driving the license. Yes, sir. Just state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Joakim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. What we're trying to do is match up this with the current U.S. Coast Guard criteria for this. The language that we've amended in our boiler bill that includes the boat licensing is that the boat guides, they have to offer for services for more than six people in their boat to be classified to meet this criteria.
Thank you.
Anything further? Anyone else desires to testify? If not, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2781 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Obermiller. Thank you, Mr. Joachim.
Thank you.
Next up is House File 3025, Representative Olin's bill. The chair will move that House File 3025 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Olin, to your bill.
First off, to put it in a shape, I need it, Mr. Chairman. I need to delete Section 27 that's of Article 1. That's a by agreement of parties that have been working on this thing. They want that section out. So I would like that as an author's amendment.
Is that page 13? Page 13.
Yeah. It's page 13.
Let me just get the representative all. And repeat for me, I'm sorry, repeat for me once more what section you want deleted.
Section 27 of Article 1, page 13.
All right.
Delete that section.
The chair will move then that Section 27 of the bill be deleted. That's lines 13.16 through 13.24. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, Representative Hoppe's vote prevails. Representative Olin, to your bill as amended.
Okay. Basically, this bill is a Bar Association bill to correct some to make some technical corrections in the business organizations, for one thing, and it's also a Secretary of State bill to correct some stuff with Secretary of State. And since both the Senate and the House are acting on this bill almost at the exact same time, I have Secretary Bert Black from the Secretary of State's office to explain the bill.
Mr. Black, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And I am Bert Black, legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State. And today I am speaking also on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Section. The Article 1 is work that was done by the Business Law Section last year, 2009. It's been approved by the Business Law Section Executive Council as well as by the Minnesota State Bar Association Legislative Committee. And it is a formal bill of the Bar Association. Article 1 relates to mainly to transactions for business corporations, limited liability companies, nonprofit organizations, I'll very briefly, I'm not going to, you have a bill summary, it's a long bill, I'm not going to go through each section of the bill summary, but I'm going to hit the highlights for Article 1 and Article 2. Article 1, The bill permits publicly held corporations that are traded on the stock exchange to eliminate or modify cumulative voting by simple majority vote instead of a supermajority, but supermajorities would still be retained for non-public and private corporations. It permits chief executive officers, as well as the board of directors, to appoint and remove officers other than the chief financial officer. So if you have the vice president of sales, that is something we spent a lot of time on in the committee of the Bar Association Business Law Section, talking about, you know, does that really need to go to the board of directors to appoint the vice president of sales in Fargo? The answer was no. And so to the extent that the board grants the authority to the chief executive officer in the articles, or it's granted in the articles or bylaws or in a board resolution, we're trying to streamline that process. It permits board of directors to make certain amendments to a corporation's articles of incorporation in connection with a stock dividend. Those amendments are permitted for stock splits and reverse stock splits, but not for stock dividends right now, as long as they meet certain requirements. It also allows the board of directors flexibility to maintain corporate records other than at the principal executive office. So, for example, if you have a large number of corporate records, you may want to store them off-site in a secure facility. Going on to nonprofit law, it clarifies the process of approval of amendments of articles and bylaws of nonprofit corporations. It clarifies that directors are not to be counted for purposes of determining the quorum if they have a conflict of interest. They couldn't vote on it if they had a conflict of interest, and therefore they believe that they shouldn't count towards having a quorum. It also permits nonprofit corporations to voluntarily provide indemnification to persons beyond the statutorily required individuals. We already have indemnification under Chapter 317A521. This allows the board to expand that. Clarifies that non-ordinary course sales of assets require member approval in a nonprofit corporation, so more control for the membership of the corporation, and provides clarifying and conforming changes to ensure that in Minnesota we try to parallel three acts: the Business Corporation Act, the Nonprofit Act, and the LLC Act. They all have the same basic text, and so we try to do maintenance. We've had changes in the past in 302A, so now we're trying to put those in the other acts. And finally, it corrects an effective date error It wasn't an error of the legislature. It was a miscalculation on the part of the drafters. We want to make sure that nonprofit limited liability companies that we instituted two years ago, that you could have a nonprofit limited liability company. Unfortunately, we put in language that made it seem as if you could only elect to be nonprofit if you had been formed after the effective date of the law. We have some existing limited liability companies that actually want to be nonprofit, and this would extend that ability to them. So that's Article 1 of the bill. Article 2 is our provisions that are proposed by the Secretary of State's office for the purpose of mainly of streamlining filing and streamlining the computer programming that we have to do. We're in the middle of doing a big project to do online filing. Most of the text that you'll see in Article 2 has to do with creating a more uniform process for designating and changing registered agents and registered offices. Business entities in this state are supposed to have a registered office. If you're a domestic organization, you don't have to have an agent, but you can. If you're a non-Minnesota organization, you have to have an agent so we can have service of process and nexus for jurisdiction. So we're putting in a more uniform process for that. We have a number of other provisions. We are allowing persons who are signing documents online, already in law, you can sign by an agent online. We're extending that to hard copy filings. We're allowing for the correction of documents that are filed on the wrong, when the filing party mistakenly files it on the wrong entity, when the filing party does that. Right now they have to go to court to correct that. We're putting in a provision that says you can correct that within 60 days of the initial filing with our office. Much simpler, won't require court time, won't require a lawyer. We're also requiring or allowing that banks and insurance companies now file, they used to file both with Commerce and our office. Now they just file with Commerce, and so this is a cleanup to make sure they are exempted from the annual renewal requirements because they're not filed with us anymore. We're also providing that assumed names will have, last year we instituted a 12-month protection if you're statutorily dissolved. We're extending that to assumed names. That way it'll cover all of the businesses in the state. We're also allowing in various places non-Minnesota corporations to use alternate names in this state if they file it with our office, with the Secretary of State. We're removing several provisions in here, parts of provisions that require forms. Forms, there's no need to use the paper form if you have all the statutory requirements in your document. And frankly, as we move towards online filing, there is no form. You just fill out the fields in the online filing, and there isn't really any choice in how to do that. We've also worked with the Cooperative Network to provide the...
Mr. Black, I know that there's at least one question at the committee, and maybe before we get too much further, okay. Representative Hoppe, you have a question or concern?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And Mr. Black, back in page 2 of the bill, in Article 1, I'm just curious, and I'm just double-checking, but when we're talking about other officers and it's giving the CEO the ability to appoint an officer or officers other than the CFO, that has to be approved by the board first. Is that correct?
Mr. Black?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, the authority to do that has to be approved either by the articles or the bylaws or by the board.
Okay.
And, of course, if it's in the articles, it's been approved by the shareholders. If it's in the bylaws, it's been approved by either by the board or the shareholders, and if it's in a resolution, then it's been approved by the board. So it's, yes, there has to be an initial delegation of that authority by some ruling body.
Thank you.
Are there other questions or concerns for Mr. Black at this time? If not, Mr. Black, we've got, in addition to your walkthrough or partial walkthrough, we've got the documents that you provided. Is there anyone else that desires to testify against the bill? If not, then the chair will renew his motion that House File 3025 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
As amended. Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen, very
much.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next up is House File 3048, Representative Norton's bill. With respect to construction codes, Chairman Davney, this came through the division. He'll move the adoption of the division report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Davney will then move that House File 3048 as amended in division be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor? I'm sorry. That would be really fast, wouldn't it? But you have an amendment. Is that right, Representative Norton?
I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, and I believe after the amendment is passed, it probably is most appropriate to go to higher education and workforce development.
Okay. We will change the motion when we get to that stage. The author's amendment, then, Representative Davney, will move the author's amendment. It's coded 810-2228. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Norton, your bill.
Thank you very much. I think I'd address the amendment first, if the chair would let me do that. I have a representative from the Department of Labor and Industry who will discuss that particular portion of the bill, as it's a new amendment, and I'm not up to speed on it quite yet.
Very good. Welcome,
Mr. Chair.
Back.
Tom Joakim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. This amendment does two things. The first lines amendments on lines 120 through 123. Clarify some language. When a homeowner obtains a judgment against a contractor, most of the contractors that they obtain these judgments from are out of business. So they can submit the dollars as they see fit. And what this does is it requires that the applicant has to provide information to us to document their out-of-pocket loss. So we can clarify that. So it just clarifies that language that we've had some difficulty in homeowners submitting what they actually spent versus what their judgment was, and so we want to clarify that documentation. The second piece of the amendment clarifies an issue that we've had. I happen to live in a condo, and if the association was filing for a judgment against a contractor that built the condo building, it's not very clear that the association can do that for the commons area issues if the roof leaked over the commons area versus in my specific unit, I could file a claim against the builder for material or products in my unit that are not functioning, but clarifying that the hallways and the roof and the commons area are also applicable to the judgment account from the contractor. That's what this section does. So two simple additions to our bill.
Representative Norton, anything you want to walk us through with respect to the bill or any highlights?
Well, I will walk you through the bill if that's the chair's desire. I will just tell you the bill deals
with... That's not the chair's desire.
mine either.
The chair's desire. Highlights, Representative Norton.
Oh,
there's got to be something exciting in here.
Well, there's
just ask
not.
Mr. Joakim. Look at him. He's all a Twitter
well,
over there.
Yes, and he can't go anywhere. this bill deals with construction codes, labor standards, and apprenticeship. It actually is quite complex and jumps around. I'm going to highlight in a sentence or two each of the sections. I will just say in the onset that both the Department of Labor and Industry, the Builders Association of Minnesota, the Minnesota Pipe Trades, various contractors and industry reps, and the unions have all worked on this over the interim, and to my knowledge, almost all the kinks have been worked out. We may have one tiny change in the next committee, but we'll see about that. And there's no opposition. So having said that, I hate to waste too much of the committee's time, but I also want to give you the opportunity to ask questions.
Well, I think
happen.
We have one, Representative Norton. Representative Mueller, you had a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, since this, with the amendment, now has to go to civil justice, I would suggest that maybe they would reconsider, because we have a shorter timeline on our, I think Rukavina is a committee that is a joint policy and finance, so I think it has a later final deadline than we do. So it has to pass ours by next week, whereas Rukavina, I think, has at least an extra week, maybe 2 weeks extra. So you might want to reroute it the opposite way.
I was going to ask that very question. Representative Norton, Mr. Rakowski, do you know what the status of it is in the Senate as far as meeting deadline? You may want to focus on getting through the policy committee side over here before you.
Mr. Chairman, John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. The bill has not received a hearing yet. It's my understanding from Senator Metzen it will be heard Monday. But to Representative Mullery's query about going to his committee, I believe this amendment we speak to, Section 34, Representative Mullery, is being deleted in this amendment. So then we don't have to go to your committee.
You didn't make that sound very nice.
Mr. Rakowski, it affects judgments, which means it has to go to our committee.
Mr. Rakowski, you want to delete all the words that say judgment in your bill now? Mr. Rakowski?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, you're referring to these changes in the contract recovery fund, I presume. I would defer to the senior member from North Minneapolis then.
Mr. Chair, I don't care which
Representative Mueller
route they take, but I would think since Rukavina has at least 2 extra weeks and we have 1 week to go, if you route it to him, I don't know that we've got quite a backlog, but we'll try and get it on. I'm pretty sure
if Representative Mullery feels the need to hear the bill, we would certainly take it to his committee.
With that, Representative Davenny will amend his motion. And renew his motion that the House File 3048 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Norton, and thank you, Mr. Joachim.
Given that excitement, we'll move on, and I will just quickly run through the sections.
Actually, you're done.
Hey, I like that even better.
Nice work.
Well, Mr. Chair, if she wants to run through.
I do not. I have no need to run through each section if you are comfortable with the bill, Mr. Chair.
Well, we try to make a point of taking a look at these things before they come to us. So, with the understanding. But thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Next up is Representative Davenny's bill. He tried to cut in line on the way up to, and now he's disappeared on us? All right. Well, we'll come back to Representative Davenny. Notably, by the way, House File 3251, which is Representative Lilly's bill, has been moved Tuesday. I think those that cared about it have been notified of it. We will hear House File 3251 on Tuesday. Next up, we'll move over the chair's bill and come back to that one. House File 1847 is Representative Fritz's bill. And Representative Fritz will move that House File 1847 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Yes.
Representative
Fritz.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Thank you. And I do have a couple of testifiers to join me also. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Ahrens, I have from the American Cancer Society, and this is Dr. Lerner, an oncologist. I'm going to grab a chair. And I'll begin, members. Thank you for hearing House File 1847. And does this then move, Mr. Chairman, to the floor? Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. House File 1847 is about improving access to oral chemotherapy. Until recently, frontline cancer chemotherapy drugs have been administered to patients intravenously or by injection while in a physician's office or clinic. Emerging oral chemotherapy drugs are becoming more common and represent the latest advances in cancer treatment. These drugs offer patients a convenient and non-invasive alternative to the intravenous and injected therapies. And I also wanted to share with you the information that I have a little bit, and then we'll get to our testifiers. But in Minnesota, 1 in 2 people will have cancer in Minnesota. one nationally, one in three. That, to me, is quite alarming. The problem is that there is an inequity in how much some cancer patients have to pay toward the cost of an oral chemotherapy drug and how much they have to pay for an intravenous injected drug that is administered in a doctor's office or clinic. When health plans categorize oral chemotherapy drugs as prescription drugs rather than part of the policyholder's medical benefit, patients are required to pay co-payments of out-of-pocket expenses and that are much higher than those for intravenous or injected chemotherapy delivered in the doctor's office. House File 1847 is to bring parity to the oral cancer preparation down in line with the intravenous and injectable cancer treatment. The solution is this House File 1847 so that insurers may not require a higher co-payment, deductible, or co-insurance amount for an oral chemotherapy drug that is required for an intravenous or administered and injected anti-cancer drug. And I have an oncologist, Dr. Lerner, from St. Paul. I'd like to turn it over to him.
Sure. Dr. Lerner, welcome to the committee. If you'll just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll pass this out. Thank you.
My name is Irving Lerner, L-E-R-N-E-R. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on behalf of cancer patients in Minnesota in support of House File 1847. By way of introduction, I have had a 36-year career in caring for cancer patients in St. Paul, followed by 5 years of directing the cancer program at the United Hospital in St. Paul, and I serve on the Midwest Division of the American Cancer Society Board of Directors. In these many years, I have experienced the evolution from primitive treatments for cancer to highly sophisticated and dramatically more effective ones. For example, I've seen the transition from non-specific cell toxins, known too accurately as cell poisons, to highly targeted therapies uniquely effective against cancer cells. Happily, these targeted cells are often delivered as pills rather than by injection. In fact, currently, oral drugs, that is, pills, represent about 10% of anti-cancer treatments. But the projection is that that number will increase to 25% by 2013. Of these oral drugs, 85% are targeted treatments, targeted to specific characteristics of the cancer cell. As such, they represent a new era in anti-cancer treatment effectiveness. Often they achieve this effectiveness while sparing the body's healthy cells, that is, with distinctly less of the miserable side effects for which cancer treatments are justifiably infamous. Clearly, in some cancers, these oral treatments are unequivocally, scientifically, shown to be the best treatments available. And in some instances, they are the only effective treatments. And I emphasize that we are not talking here about guesswork, but scientifically established effectiveness. In all of medicine, the field of oncology is clearly the leader in utilizing bona fide evidence-based medicine. And I want to give you one very special example. Perhaps you've heard of the drug Gleevec, which had a lot of notoriety just a few years ago. And what you may not know is that this was designed, invented, and manufactured in the laboratory by a St. Paul native. And this drug is only available as a pill, and it represents head and shoulders the very best treatment for certain cancers. In point of fact, it has essentially eliminated the need for one of the most arduous of all treatments and the enormously expensive bone marrow transplantation in the disease chronic myelocytic leukemia. In other instances, both oral and injectable drugs have comparable effectiveness, but the injectable is associated with dramatically more inconvenience to patients and significantly higher overall medical costs of administration. Think about costs of administration. Injectable treatments can only be given in sophisticated treatment centers by highly trained professionals utilizing expensive equipment and often require multiple injections or protracted infusions. This is a hardship for all patients, but especially for those who need to travel long distances to the center. And cancer treatment centers nationally and certainly in Minnesota generally serve patients from considerable distances away. Cancer causes enough hardship to patients, adding frequent, significant travel, multiple injections or infusions, and serious side effects when a pill will do better is just plain bad medicine. The problem is, as you've just heard, that injectable drugs delivered in medical centers or hospitals though often equally as expensive as oral drugs, in general require only modest copays by the patient. While oral drugs are treated as prescription drugs for which out-of-pocket costs to the patients are substantial. It is well documented that too often patients either don't fill prescriptions or take reduced, ineffective doses of their pills when they can't afford them. The net result is that patients and their physicians are pressured to choose what may be less effective, more toxic treatments to avoid the personal cost. Ironically, in some cases, the cost of the injectable treatment, when the cost of the drug and delivery is considered, is also higher than the oral, but not to the patient. In these cases, the cost to the patient of using the injectable in place of the oral treatment will be less, but the cost to all of us will be greater. Cancer patients should be able to work with their physicians to determine the best course of treatment for their disease. Patients and their physicians should not be put in a situation where the patient's out-of-pocket costs are so substantial that the patients and their treating physicians are essentially forced to choose less effective, more toxic, more inconvenient, and sometimes more costly treatment. Currently, oral medications are scientifically established to represent the best option for certain patients, providing their best chance of cure or quality control. And the projections are that this will increasingly be the case going forward. We need to address this coverage disparity issue now before the problem worsens. On behalf of the cancer patients we serve in Minnesota, I ask you to support this legislation, and I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lerner. Mr. Ahrens?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. Thank you, Representative Fritz, for leading the way. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. Cancer Society is the largest voluntary organization of cancer patients, caregivers, and survivors in the United States and throughout the country. As Representative Fritz pointed out, cancer is the leading cause of death in our state, and one out of every two of us will likely hear the words, "You have cancer." So this is obviously a serious, somber issue in what is otherwise one of the funnest committees we have in the legislature. Representative Fritz's bill is an opportunity to help cancer patients afford medicine they absolutely must take in order to save their life. Right now, the American Cancer Society is hearing more and more about cancer patients' out-of-pocket costs they have to pay for to access oral chemotherapy that's in the hundreds or thousands of dollars per month. Cancer patients should not have to choose each month whether to pay for medicine or food or utilities bills. Those things are all necessities. It shouldn't be one or the other. Like all other treatments for life-threatening diseases, oral chemotherapy medicines are expensive. However, unlike the choices of medications to treat other illnesses, cancer patients have no choice but to adhere to specific treatments directed by their oncologist. They can't pick a substitute to an oral chemotherapy medicine if one does not exist. And copays should not get in the way of patients affording these medicines. Copays were really intended to curb the overuse of certain medicine and medical technology, but cancer patients are not overusing chemotherapy. They're not overusing something that makes their hair fall out and makes them nauseous. But I'd like to take a moment and address the cost issue that you may hear testimony about, that this bill will result in increasing insurance premiums. I think we can learn from other states' experiences with regard to this legislation. Oregon, Vermont, Hawaii, Indiana, and Iowa have all passed oral chemotherapy laws. In Oregon, for example, where oral chemotherapy has been in place the longest since 2007, albeit it is a young bill, when health insurance has to request the permission to raise premium rates, there were, from 2008 to 2009, there were 79 premium rate change requests in Oregon. Only 9 of the 79 cited oral chemotherapy parity as a contributor. In the other 70 requests by the health plans, the new law had no impact on the plan's request for a premium increase. The percentage increase in medical and prescription rates cited by these health plans attributed to oral chemotherapy parity was in most cases less than 1%. Let's take Vermont as an example. Their Department of Banking, Insurance, Securities, and Healthcare Administration, quote, does not believe the state's mandate for orally administered anti-cancer medication will significantly impact premiums for Vermonters. I know we're not Vermonters. I'm glad we're in Minnesota, but other states do provide some examples. California, which has not passed this bill yet, did a governmental analysis of the California's oral chemotherapy parity bill and stated that the average portion of a premium paid by the employer would increase only between 3 cents and 24 cents per member per month. I'm wondering if we're willing to pay 3 cents to 24 cents more so that someone can access life-saving cancer medicine they must take, which is the difference between life and death in certain cases. The point here is that the law is not a problem in other states in terms of insurance rates. Rather, the laws are helping patients. Moreover, other states seem to be able to implement the law. And we know Minnesota has a sophisticated health plan system, and American Cancer Society is the first organization that would like to work with the health plans to help implement the law. And I think the health plans will say the same thing, but we are working together. We're in a dialogue right now about how we can make sure medicines that cancer patients need become more affordable. One thing is clear. If we want to save lives and wisely use healthcare dollars, then why not make sure that the few cancer patients that must have oral chemotherapy medicine can access it to save their life? These medicines, as the doctor said, have proven effective, some with fewer side effects. Enabling cancer patients to avoid long road trips to the hospital, get hooked up to an IV drip, and then face a long drive home with bad nausea is something that oral chemotherapy medicines can help avoid. I want to close by sharing with you a very, very short story, knowing time is limited. This is the story of an American Cancer Society volunteer that's very active with us, and her name is Robbie Ann, and she's from Pura, Minnesota. She's a tremendous volunteer, and she's currently in her second bout of breast cancer. She was on intravenous chemotherapy. When she was on intravenous chemotherapy, she had to drive every week in about an hour and a half to Fergus Falls and back. And on the way back, she had fully nauseated the entire way and exhausted, and the medicine did not stop the cancer. The medicine did not stop the cancer. It metastasized again. Right now, she's on an oral chemotherapy medicine called Ticurb for breast cancer. It's an oral chemotherapy medicine. She gets her medicine through the mail, through a specialty pharmacy, and takes it at home. She has no long drive, she has far less nausea, and no hair loss. More importantly, the medicine seems to be working for Robbie Ann, and her cancer prognosis gets better every day. She's only 35 years old, and we are hoping with affordability we can make sure Robbie Ann continues to get the medicine she needs. If she can be cured, she can work, she can be a great employee, she could run a business and contribute even more than she already does. Robbie Ann finds a way to afford the out-of-pocket costs each month because she lives at home and gets help from her parents. On behalf of her and others like Robbie Ann, I'd ask for your support for this bill and very much respect and appreciate your time and listening to our side of the issue as well as the other sides of the issue and getting a full hearing. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. Representative Fritz, do you have other testifiers and as proponents of the bill?
I do not. Actually, the Tillsdales are not able to make it this evening, and so we are.
Okay. I saw that they have been on an earlier version. I just wanted to make sure we didn't miss them if they were here.
No. Thank you for asking.
You bet. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else here that desires to? Representative Muller, you got a burning question before we?
Yes, Mr.
Move
Chair.
On?
The chair has to stop offensive language, and there's four of us in a row here that are wondering about offensive language about hair loss.
I didn't find it offensive at all.
Thank you. No offense, Matt, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Hesse and Ms. Comet, I understand, want to testify as well. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, we'll just move over.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council is a trade association that represents the 7 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I want to remind the committee that health plans cover cancer treatments, including chemotherapy, both by infusion and IV, as well as oral chemotherapy drugs. We cover all of these medications. Chemotherapy for the treatment of cancer is usually administered by injection or infusion and generally occurs in a clinic or outpatient setting. It is covered as a medical benefit. Oral chemotherapy is a positive development for some persons with certain types of cancers, and currently most benefit plans cover oral chemotherapy under their pharmacy benefit, as Representative Fritz mentioned earlier, either as a regular drug or as a specialty formulary benefit. This bill seeks to equalize how enrollee cost sharing is handled for cancer chemotherapy treatments. The design and pricing of healthcare benefits takes into account many factors, but probably one of the most important factors considered is what is the underlying cost structure of that particular service. All healthcare benefits are developed this way, including chemotherapy treatment. In today's economy, employers are struggling to balance the cost of premiums against out-of-pocket costs. Employers make these choices as to which plans they can afford based on many factors, including whether they can afford more upfront costs in their premium that comes with lower out-of-pocket costs, or a lower premium with higher out-of-pocket costs. Premiums reflect the cost of health care, and increased costs lead directly to increased premiums. Employers typically choose the plan design for their employees based on the most comprehensive health insurance coverage they can afford to purchase, as well as how they want to share the cost with their employees. I think you probably have a copy of this, but in case you don't, I don't know if the page is nearby. I just wanted to pass out a copy of this graph. Perhaps you have that in your packet?
We do actually have it in the packet, Ms. Quinn.
Just to make sure that people understand that if this legislation passes, how our market is structured here in Minnesota, and that 27% of the market is covered by 27% of the market is under the fully insured market. So that's the portion of the market over which you have control as state legislators. Let me just go quickly to the bottom line. Health plans cover these medications that help patients battle cancer. Oral chemotherapy drugs are expensive. Chemo treatments are covered in different ways depending on where the medication is delivered. This bill could actually result in patients paying more out-of-pocket costs. Regardless, the intent of this bill would place upward pressure on premiums, and so for that reason we oppose this legislation. This is about cost. This is about sharing some of the cost with the enrollee or pushing more of the cost to the employer through the premiums. How much does the patient pay, and how much does the employer pay? And who should decide? The cost doesn't go away. It simply cost shifts more of the cost to the employer. I want to just add two things. One, we have been in dialogue with Mr. Ahrens all day today and have been working with Mr. Ahrens and other folks from the Cancer Society on this issue for the past week. And we're continuing to make some progress on discussions around this bill. We're continuing to work with him, and this bill I believe is going to the floor, but we are both committed to working together to continuing to negotiate on this bill. The one final thing I just want to mention is that since Mr. Ahrens brought up what's happening in some other states, it is true that this bill has passed or something similar has passed in other states. I do want to just mention California, since he brought it up, and California did pass legislation on this issue last year, but the governor vetoed the bill. And let me just read two paragraphs from his veto message, because I think it's relevant here. And I quote, "While I have historically supported greater access to necessary pharmaceutical treatments and appreciate the author and the sponsor's intent, I cannot support this particular measure. For those patients fortunate enough to have health coverage in today's economic environment, health plans already provide coverage for oral anti-cancer medications. This bill limits a plan's ability to control both the appropriateness of the care and the cost by requiring to immediately cover every medication as soon as it receives federal approval, regardless of the provisions of the health plan's formulary, placing them at a severe disadvantage when negotiating prices with drug manufacturers. I do believe that oral anti-cancer medications can be more cost-effective and efficacious in some instances, If there is a way to provide greater access without increasing overall costs, I would be willing to reconsider such a measure next year. I would encourage a collaborative approach with my administration, the health plans, and the pharmaceutical manufacturers next year on this topic. And actually, that is what we're doing. We're working together in collaboration with the Cancer Society, and I wanted to make sure you were aware of that, but it still is for these reasons we oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Commit. We appreciate that. Mr. Hesse, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The chamber also opposes House File 1847 at this time, and we do so because it is another mandate that will only apply to the fully insured market. And as you just heard, that represents 27% of those with health insurance, typically small employers and individuals. This is a different type of mandate than you usually look at. It doesn't mandate a coverage, as Ms. Commit said. It's already covered under Minnesota law. This requires plans to pay for this treatment in a certain way, and we suggest that's better left up to the marketplace to decide what level of copays and deductibles and cost sharing arrangements should be allowed for the various employers in the state. I think it's pretty simple. If you reduce or change coverage from an area that has high cost sharing to an area that has lower cost sharing, that the dollars just don't go away. They have to be found somewhere, and that will likely show up in the premiums that an employer pays. Having said all that, there is an alternative, and I have had conversations with representatives of the health plans and the Cancer Society and the pharmaceutical folks that are interested in this legislation, and we really do encourage and hope that they can come to some resolution to this issue without legislation, that can find a way to make the oral treatments available and in a way that does not increase premiums to employers. And we hope those conversations can continue, and hopefully the end result will be something that we could support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to comment and respond to that. This is not a new mandate at all. The mandate is already in state. Yes, could you? All right. They might have questions for you.
And thank you. And Representative Fritz, if you can
I will wrap
provide
up.
Your reply, and then we'll take a few questions from members of the committee.
What this does is offer patients who have cancer access and affordability. And their life. As a nurse, I've cared for many people that received chemotherapy. Even my neighbor, who was returned home with a PIC-IV in him to receive his medication, and with the adverse effects of those intravenous medications come nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, pain, and they require more and more medications. They require morphine and Lamotil and Phenergan and antiemetics and all of these things. We have evolved in medicine to the point where we can administer an oral preparation for our cancer patients without those horrible side effects and additional medications. The insurance agency should join us and evolve with us and pay for them in a responsible manner. That's what I have. All I have to say.
Thank you, Representative Fritz. And Representative Davids, I think, had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to correct Representative Fritz on one thing, it's not the insurance agency making these decisions, it's insurance companies.
Thank you.
Two quick questions I think the first one's for Ms. Commit. You said in your testimony that this could actually cost the client more, and then you said it may raise premiums. If it's costing the client more, how does it raise premiums?
Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Davids, the way it would raise premiums is that if this bill were to pass and be enacted, it would have the effect of capping or limiting what the enrollee cost sharing could be for these types of medications. Those costs don't go away. Those costs would have to be shifted somewhere else, and those would eventually end up as higher premiums for that employer who's paying the premiums for that employer's group. The other thing is, if this bill were to pass and we were required to change the way the benefit structure is developed, people who actually pay There are some very expensive drugs. Let me back up and say there are some very expensive drugs that do some wonderful things. Gleevec was mentioned. That can cost as much as over $50,000 a year. The enrollee cost sharing for Gleevec is might be something in the neighborhood of $200 per month for that particular medication if it's taken orally. If the law is changed to require the enrollee cost sharing to be on par with what is done on the medical side, then typically what happens over on that side is an 80-20 share cost share, and so it could actually be more than what that $200 is per month.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, so you could actually be lowering the price for employers on their health plans because the employee would be paying more.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I think it would vary between across different employers. So you may have some employers that are going to see maybe the costs don't go up, but on the other hand, you might see some that do experience cost increases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two points here. As far as group coverage goes, maybe a question for Mr. Pender. Of that 27%, how much of that is group and how much of that is individual? Are there any fee-for-service groups out there yet?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, the 27% would be employer groups who buy coverage in the fully insured market.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Pender, that also be individual policies included in that 27%, like Blue Cross Options Blue or Personal Blue or.
I'd have to look at the chart.
Well, I guess I'll visit with Mr. Pender about that later. But a question for both Mr. Hesse and Ms. Commit. If this bill was not moving forward, what would your dialogue be like with the American Cancer Society?
Ms. Commit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, our dialogue would be, this idea of changing the way medical or pharmaceutical benefits are administered versus medical benefits would be is a bigger change than just passing this legislation and putting a cap on it. It really would represent a fundamental change of how healthcare benefits are administered and provided. And so we are happy to have that conversation. We are having that conversation with the Cancer Society now about this. But I think it's a bigger task to accomplish than simply just making it so in statute. It would require a lot of implementation challenges.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I would encourage you to work with the American Cancer Society on this, and hopefully we can achieve peace in the valley.
And Mr. Pender does have an answer to your question. Mr. Pender.
Representative Davids, Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, having looked at the pie chart now, the 27% represents the total proportion of Minnesotans who are getting coverage in the fully insured market. So that would include small employers, large employers who are not self-insured, and the individual market.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then we have the list, Representative Sanders and Representative Anderson. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fritz, for bringing this forward, for at least nothing else, to intensify the negotiations and really bring some more attention to this issue. I wish some of these oral medications have been around when my younger brother had intense cancer, so I'm very satisfied with the direction that we're moving here. But listening to the recent testimony here, I just, since we are dealing with how benefits will be administered, whether or not they will be covered, my question to you is, what impact will this have on CGIP, for instance? Have you talked to anyone at CGIP who administers that program, if there is an impact there at all?
Actually, I have not talked with them, and I'm, this is good that the plans are meeting with the American Cancer Society, and actually no one has made an appointment to see me in my office about this legislation, so I welcome the discussions going forward. The chamber, I've never met this gentleman before, but I have talked
to
some.
He's a really nice guy.
Yes, I appreciate that.
And a constituent of mine, so be nice to him.
I've been here 6 years. I do have an office, so I invite them to come by anytime. And this is an issue, of course, very near and dear to my heart, having been a nurse for 40 years. And I, too, you know, when I think about people like myself, 65 years of age, and thank God I am cancer-free, but it could happen any day. And I live in an era, and we all do, where we have made such advances that I could actually have a pill and go home and become, and heal in the comfort of your own home, as to drive up to an oncology place in the cities to receive any kind of treatment. So we have come a long way, and I hope that this legislation goes a long way. And I know that the plans do have some work to do, and this is what they do. And I'm giving them a little more work to do, and hopefully we'll all come out for the better.
Thank you. Representative Sanders?
Mr. Chair, and I guess I don't know... necessarily, I don't remember what the process was, where this bill is going. I don't know if it is going to the floor, if it's not going to go somewhere like state government finance. No. I hope you at least have those conversations before it comes to the floor, so we could know if there is an impact on
such. Be happy
programs.
To. Excellent.
Representative
Thank
Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fritz and Mr. Hesse, Ms. Commit. Have we ever looked at if we might be prolonging how high the cost of these medications are by doing something like this, because, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are going to have some, you know, better options, more people using it. Do we have any, is this been done in Europe, so we have some statistics that way? Do you guys have any idea if we might be, do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I thought that.
Prolonging the, because typically you have a new medicine out there, you know, at the first part of it, it's expensive, and then as it becomes more widely used, it lowers and goes down in costs. And I'm just wondering if anybody's looked at that at all.
Well, Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think what you're talking about is when will these drugs have an opportunity to go off patent, perhaps, and be available as generics? And part of the challenge with this issue is that these drugs are typically in a category called biologics, and they're formulated from living cells as opposed to chemical compounds, which are other types of drugs that are chemical compounds, and they are regulated by the FDA, and they are on patent and do go off patent, and then generics are generic drug manufacturers manufacture those. In this case, biologics aren't treated the same way, and therefore they never revert to a generic form. And so that's something that the federal government has been looking at, and it is part of the discussions that have been part of the federal health care reform, to put some limits in place to get these drugs that are very, very successful at treating many different types of diseases but are very expensive, and is there a way to try to move that from this pure biologics to a generic format eventually? But right now there's nothing that will change that. So that's why these drugs are very, very expensive.
All right. Representative Hopp, you get the last question or final concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask, and I lost it here in my notes somewhere, the doctor that was down testifying earlier, I had your name written down. Sorry, doctor.
He's on his way down.
Okay,
I
will ask
the question as he comes.
As I read the bill and I look at it, and it says that the health plan that's providing this coverage can't charge more for this than they're charging for the traditional IV, aren't they charging more because they're being charged more by the drug companies? I mean, isn't this just more expensive?
Dr. Lerner, to the extent you're aware of that?
I don't think that's the answer. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I can't remember your name. You can't remember mine.
I like this.
Okay.
You don't live in Chaska, do you?
I don't. Good. I vote there, but I don't live there.
Dr. Lerner.
In any event, I think the costs of oral anti-cancer drugs varies considerably. It is true that the newer ones, the ones I alluded to as targeted therapies, can be very expensive because they were horrendously expensive to develop. That's the biggest reason they're so expensive. At the other end of the spectrum are oral drugs that have been around for ages, since I began that many years ago, and they are very cheap. So oral drugs can vary all over the place. So can injectable drugs. Some of them are biologicals, and every bit as expensive, plus the administration. So I won't deny that this isn't very expensive treatment, but I don't think that's the distinction between oral and injectable.
Thank you, Dr. Lerner. Representative Hoppe?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Lerner. I mean, I think the whole reason for this bill is because people are being charged more for these drugs, and maybe it's only a few of them, and I think this is the wave of the future, and we're all going to have to figure out a way to do it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think that's why the bill is here. I mean, if these oral drugs were the same cost or less expensive, we wouldn't have this before us. And I think we do need to get together with Representative Fritz and yourself and the Cancer Society and the coverage companies, the insurance companies, and find a solution for this, for all of us going forward. And as I have been learning today, it sounds like the percentage of these people that are using the oral drugs is going to go up exponentially in the years to come as we develop more and more miracle drugs, and they are expensive. But Representative Fritz, I would encourage you and encourage the parties to keep working on this and try to do what Representative Davids and Mr. Hesse said and try to find some kind of peace in the valley and some way we can reach an accommodation on how we pay for these drugs. Thank you.
And I think we all appreciate all the testimony that indicated a desire to try to figure something out to make this work. So, Representative Fritz, with that, renews our motion that House File 1847 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Fritz, and thank you to everyone that came to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Dabney, is House File 3127, and Representative Dabney will move that House File 3127 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Now, Representative Dabney, it is my understanding that there is a handful of authors' amendments.
There are, Mr. Chair. Some are authors, some are not. All are acceptable, however, to the author.
Okay. Well, why don't we take them in rapid fashion, and then we'll go back and explain the bill as amended. Representative Dabney will move the 810-2197 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Dabney will move the 810-2142 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dabney will move the H3127A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Dabney to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was a remarkable moment. Members, this is the Uninsurance Employment Advisory Committee bill for this year as amended. As you know, the trust fund is not in good shape, currently in deficit and projected to be in deficit for a number of years. While this week's reduced unemployment numbers are good, they are not near good enough for the corpus of the fund. The current statute, which will be amended in this bill, would, through an anomaly, provide an automatic decrease in employer tax rates, which would have the effect of increasing the amount of the deficit. That's a bad thing. The proposal would modify the current statute to provide the tax rates will not decrease so long as the trust fund remains in deficit. It provides an incentive for employers to prepay unemployment insurance taxes early. This is a win-win. By providing this discount, it strengthens the fund and provides the employers with a discount for paying it. Everybody wins. And it provides that new employers in the construction industry will receive an average tax rate for construction industry employers rather than the current fixed rate. With that, I ask for member support.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Unless there's questions, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anybody against it?
Representative Dabney?
Not that I'm aware of. Do you want to change that?
No.
The Representative Dabney, are you aware of a request higher ed workforce development sometimes sees or all the time sees these sorts of bills?
Mr. Chair, I've not had any conversation with anyone from that committee. I do understand that they often want to see these bills, however.
Well, why don't it's set for the General Register. If you would give us a promise that you'll just visit with the higher ed folks and see if they want to. There was just some concern that similar bills have always gone off to higher ed. I think as long as we're going to General Register, there's no sense sidetracking you. But if they do want to hear it, obviously you're a gentleman, and I'm sure you'll go wherever any chair wants to have your bill heard. So
I'm a gentleman, and they're scholars, so
yeah,
between
indeed.
The two, we're covered.
So with that, Representative Dabney will renew his motion that House File 3127 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries.
Thank you,
Representative
Dabney.
Representative Abler's bill is up next. That is House File 1503. And the chair moved that House File 1503 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections. Representative Abler, thank you, and welcome back to the committee. What I would request that you do is, as I'm sure you know, the components of your bill that are actually before this committee are relative to, I think there's one line on insurance,
That's correct.
And there's like three lines relative to continuing ed requirements. And I don't think there's any testing, Representative Davids, just so we're... But if you could confine your testimony to those pieces and to have your testifiers do the same, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, they've been so coached. So, and we only have one. And if you, someone could move the bill.
I would be happy to. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Davids will move the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion prevails. Representative Abler.
Well, actually, what you just did in that motion, you made the bill even a better bill. There were some issues about fencing and who can do it and who can't. Now, having discussed with some of the people of concern, especially Centerpoint, this is makes the bill better, and so you did that. The part you're looking at, especially, is on page 6. There's two lines on lines 633 and 34 about liability insurance. With that, I'll turn it to my witness, and then we'll be done.
Thank you, Representative Abel. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jeremy Miller. I'm here today in the capacity of Government Relations Chair for the Minnesota Chapter of the American Massage Therapy Association and Chair of the grassroots group, the Alliance for Licensing Massage Therapists. I've been a professional massage therapist since 1997, and I work at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in the Department of Integrated Medicine. As I understand, this bill has been, as this bill has been heard and passed in the Licensing and Health Policy Committees, I understand the Chair has requested that the testimony be kept to the lines about malpractice insurance, and I'm happy to do that. In states with massage credentialing, of which there are 43 plus the District of Columbia, complaints per 1,000 practitioners last year ran as high as 28 complaints per 1,000 massage therapists. This is higher than the reported ratios from the last biennial reports for Minnesota's nurses, physical therapists, and social workers combined. In the documents provided, the first one labeled disciplinary trends, you will see disciplinary actions taken in the state of Texas by the Texas Department of State Health Services. Over 38% were for violations related to failure to provide standard of care, the category most likely to elicit a malpractice claim. Massage therapists are able to get malpractice insurance easily, and I'm happy to share more about that later if anybody needs to clarification. In the printed materials, there's also a compilation of insurance claims from the years 2000 and 2008. The American Massage Therapy Association's claims data show claims relating to ineffective treatment, failure to consult with or refer a client to an appropriate medical provider, and treatment errors averaged $18,000 per claim. Finally, 1503 enacts a voluntary title protection so anybody who opposes on grounds of this insurance provision or any other provision, including the continuing education, can simply choose not to register under the state regulation and continue to practice as they always have. There is a clear need for liability insurance and liability insurance for massage therapists, and I encourage you to vote yes on House File 1503. Thank you, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I've got three other people on the list, Ms. York, Ms. Johnson-Palava, and Mr. Schmidt. And Representative Davids, you have a question for Mr. Miller?
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two points here. First of all, I know we're supposed to kind of concentrate on the insurance part, but my concern about this bill, I think, is addressed in, I guess I'll just, in my case, I'm going to take my case here. I go see massage therapist every Friday morning, unless we're in session. And he's in his 70s, and he's pretty much awesome. He's been to all the schools and all that kind of happy stuff. And sometimes folks of that age will say that, well, if I have to go through all this, I'm just going to quit. I don't want him to quit. Where in the bill does it say that he grandfathers out of some of this stuff? And
well, Mr. Miller? Chair, Representative Davids, there is a grandfathering clause. Section is under Section 3, I believe, or 4.
Mr. Chair, while he's finding that, let me just offer
Representative Abler.
If a person wishes the credential with the grandfathering clause, if a person chooses to do nothing, they can do nothing. And I talked to Representative Davids about your town, which doesn't have any regulation at all. Nothing will change.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abler, I'm looking at the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm kind of concerned about this. It just made me a little nervous here. Their response, the league supports a statewide regulation of massage therapists in order to aid local law enforcement efforts to control prostitution and other criminal activity. What are we doing here?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Davids. Well, actually, that's the reason for the bill, at least one of the reasons for the bill. In the past, cities have regulated this establishment under the guise of minimizing prostitution. And so
Yikes.
Anyway, I think your guy is probably okay, but the but that's been the issue all along, and so this has been a 21-year process to try to get this some kind of credential for this group. And so now they can be treated like the professionals that they are if they choose to get that credential. If you have a credential, you can lose it if you misbehave. And the data on the malpractice and the awards on the complaints have been of the kind that you would kick some people out, then they would have lost their credential. They could, and so, but a person can practice yet without any of this.
So, Mr. Chairman, and
David, this going to be on insurance or continuing ed?
Well,
or?
It may be my life insurance. Yeah. So, where I go every Friday morning is licensed under prostitution statute.
Mr.
Representative
Representative David, your city has chosen to do nothing to oversee this fine man because he doesn't need anybody to watch him. So
we're okay.
You're okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right.
Thank you, Representative Davids. I named off a few people. If you'd like to come down in any order and either talk about the insurance piece or the continuing education piece. And thank you, Mr. Miller. We appreciate your testimony as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I am president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. In the interest of time and because you're talking specifically about the issues that were brought up, I'm going to yield to Barbara York. I will just say that Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project is unequivocally opposed to this bill. We think title protection is not consumer protection. It's done to protect the industry, and I don't see how it protects the citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Ms. York?
Thank you. Thank you. Members, Vivian, the chair, thank you very much for hearing us today. This is claimed as a voluntary registration, but as it's been noted not only in this committee already, but in the Thursday night meeting of the licensing subcommittee, that the proponents of the bill and Tom Hindlemeyer from the Department of Health acknowledged that the cities would make this mandatory. And so even cities that may not have a prostitution ordinance at this time may decide to adopt this. We have a 146A client bill of rights that supersedes the prostitution ordinance simply because it does not require police officers to get undressed. They can simply walk in and ask for that client bill of rights. And therefore, we already have a state statute in place and has been effective. What you'll also notice is that the registration by grandfathering is effective for only 1 year.
Say, Ms. York?
Yes.
Well, I appreciate your concerns about all parts of it.
This will lead into the education and the insurance. This is focused to the insurance.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
What happens is that not only will the cities make this mandatory, as noted in the licensing committee, but additionally, the grandparenting limit would force people to choose whether to continue or leave the business. I just received an article today from Detroit where they have passed a registration, but they acknowledged the experts are saying that many of the part-timers would probably be forced out of business. This eliminates jobs, often where people are making ends meet. If they choose to or wait to fail to apply and their city makes it mandatory, say 2 years later, they're out of luck for qualifying. With this bill, their only option at that point would take the required education and pass a national exam. If they think they might be able to ground, the risk goes up for both practitioner and client, not because of educational issues, but in the most common, in the IMA, you also have that document on the third page of the materials that I just gave you. The IMA says over 80% of insurance payouts by professional liability insurance is on trip and fall. The basic trip and fall insurance, whether it comes from Massage Insurance Group or their own business or homeowner renter's insurance, would be null and void at that point because they had not gotten the registration. In a scenario of the sidewalk being icy and the client slips and has a closed head injury, along with a torn rotator cuff or a broken leg, the practitioner could lose their home and all their assets. The insurance risks and qualifications, the International Massage Association will ensure practitioners only have 100 hours of education. They support the part-timers, and they support people who are just making ends meet with this. From this group of practitioners, they have no claims for all the years they've been doing this. But the people with the higher education, as noted in the proponent's documents, the ABMP requires the education and the national exam, and they're the ones that have claims. So the education has not protected the consumer, unless this really is trip and fall. And if you look at the material further, and that's on my second page, you'll see that most of it probably is. The professional liability insurance is inexpensive because there is a lack of harm. This has never been brought in any state, let alone this state, by a consumer protection group because there is no harm. It is always brought by the schools and educators. This is not about the consumer. This isn't even about the practitioner. This is about putting it through a national insurance group, whereas you can get your renters, you can get a business rider for $115 that will give you $300,000 and $1,000 medical, or for another $9, you can get $1 million per occurrence and $5,000 for medical. So they're asking that this be a national group of insurance when it's not necessary. The proponents have failed to bring you actual proof of harm. They have two documents that they would like to present here. I checked one out with the insurance professional liability insurance, and the other one with the legal department of one of our hospital groups here in the cities. Their list of trip and their list of injuries from the ABMP are most likely trip and fall, a shoulder injury from a chair massage, although they don't give you the background on what these things are, but that is most often the problem with a chair massage is fainting. It's a common occurrence in chair massages that people will faint after when they try to get up, and that can very well cause a shoulder injury. You'll also notice a dislocated sternum, most likely from CPR. And then down in the Minnesota Council Health Board's report, they had a strange list in 2003. They don't say where it's from. It says 16 cases. And this is what I checked out with the hospital. One of these is more likely from a birthing accident. One involves...
Say, Ms. York, if I might, can I just interrupt? So you object to the insurance provision?
Yes, I do. I oppose. I'm sorry. I do oppose this.
You object to insurance being required?
No, I'm saying that the majority insurance being required would be for trip and fall. It is not. It's not.
No,
it's
I get that. But
any business. But as far as malpractice insurance and as far as actual harm to a client because of massage therapy, does not exist. Not in any terms that you would be alarmed by, and has not been brought by a consumer protection group. And okay. So
thank
what
you.
They say here is that massage therapists are rarely implicated in any harm. And if you look at the very last page of the document, you'll see that the Department of Health, I'm sorry, still in my larger package. The last page of your document shows the summary of the report. And the bottom is that based on experience, history, data, and knowledge of health regulation, the Council of Health Boards acknowledge that voluntary systems of regulation are ineffective in establishing competency standards and protecting public safety. I've just jumped in without even telling you who I am. I'm Barbara York. I'm the president of the Therapeutic Massage Network. I represent practitioners. I am a volunteer. We are not a school. We don't have insurance group. So we have passed bills that protect the consumer and have been endorsed and with no opposition been put through by practitioners, and that's the 146A and the 609, which takes care of the sexual assault portion. It makes it a felony, which is higher than most other states have required.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. York.
I'm very happy to talk to anyone in this either now or after the meetings.
All right. Thank you very much.
This would eventually put me out of business. I've been practicing since 1987. Since 1983. I've been working on this since 1987. there's only so much more continuing education that I would want to have. I can qualify for this bill, but my needs for continuing education are small, very small. And I can do what I've been doing for the rest of my practicing days. I have never harmed anyone. And you'll never find, I don't believe you'll find someone who will say, I was harmed. You'll find someone who will say, I didn't like their style of massage. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to Representative Abler here, I was just looking, and I just want to clarify something here on the grandfathering, and I can see where folks could grandfather in various different ways, but then it says registration by grandfathering is effective for 1 year after the first date the board has made application, but that's only if the city has the ordinances. If there's a city that doesn't have any, this doesn't apply.
Representative Abler?
If the person is registered under this bill and the city has an ordinance, this supersedes that ordinance. They don't have to register, license in the city or pay any city fee. Some cities have $8,300 fees. And then the grandfathering expiring in a year is because that's the renewal time. So they would renew as anybody else and pay their annual fee and be done. They're still fully qualified. Once they meet the grandfathering, they don't need any additional requirement to be registered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I did have a couple, at least one other testifier, Ms. Johnson-Palava. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairman Atkins and representatives. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. I came here, I'm Carrie Johnson-Palava, and I am director of CenterPoint Massage and Shiatsu Therapy School and Clinic in Minneapolis. We've been graduating massage therapists since 1985 and shiatsu therapists since 1992. I represent over 1,400 graduates in Minnesota. We are the oldest and maybe the largest school for massage therapy in Minnesota. I also, sort of by default today, represent AOBTA Minnesota, which is the American Organization of Bodywork Therapies from Asia, both Minnesota chapter and national. And I understand that I am to keep this to insurance and continuing education, but there is one large issue that is important for this, and that is that there is a much larger scope of massage therapy than what's being represented in this bill. So I came with a very, you've received letters, I believe, in your packets. But my business partner, Jackson Petersburg, and I, we began, and Representative Abler was talking about this process has been for 20-some years. My business partner, Jackson, and I have started the legislative process, the state effort, back in the year 1990 and 91. And we have been, for 16, 17 years, we worked very diligently to bring a good bill. I would love to support good regulation for massage therapy. There's nothing I would like better. But this is a very narrow scope for Minnesota. There is another profession, shiatsu massage, which needs to be included in this bill, and it could be very easily included. The National Professional Organization, all Asian bodywork therapists can be covered by liability insurance. There is a national certification exam, and continuing education is part of it. I have been in contact with Representative Abler and the committee that's working for regulation here, and I really appreciate the amendment today for the deletion of moxibustion, because that is within the scope of practice. And Abler worked hard and worked with me on that. The one other big issue is that Asian bodywork therapy is not part of this bill, and it really needs to be part of this bill. In the state of New York, Asian bodywork therapy is a requirement. It's a 300-hour requirement of a 1,000-hour bill for the state of New York. In the state of Louisiana, there's a dual modality bill for massage therapists and Asian bodywork therapists. In the states that have a strong massage therapy bill, such as Florida and Connecticut, no Asian bodywork therapists can practice and no Asian bodywork educational programs begin in the state of Florida or Connecticut. So even though I would love to support this bill, I would ask you to not pass it unless there is an included amendment to include Asian bodywork therapy as part of this bill. I really would love to see regulation for massage therapy in Minnesota. It just needs to be a broader scope, more inclusive than what this bill does at this point. So I've cut it really short because I know the scope of this committee is a little more narrow, but I want to thank you and see if you have any questions.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions or concerns for this witness or for other witnesses? All right, Representative Abler, you want to wrap up your comments with respect to the bill?
Well, I'll stand for questions. Just a comment. Having met with the last testifier, this amendment was in reference to that discussion. And no one, the summary, we've discussed the malpractice thing, a one-minute summary of the bill. No one has been stopped by this. The grandfathering standards are relatively low. You have to meet one of four criteria, including having worked 2 years as a massage therapist without any discussion about going to any particular school. It's low by standards of that. The intention was to fence no one out. The amendment fences fewer people out. And so it gives a chance to give this group of people who have earned a credential a credential. I think at a later time, next year, the year after, we could try to find a way to work the Asian piece in. But most everybody who is in that kind of work would qualify under this bill to work in their city if they chose to. Under this credential, and the city would leave them alone. No one has to do this in the city of Preston. I don't think they're going to do it. Minneapolis doesn't have an ordinance. They're probably not going to add one. And so with that, I'll stand for questions or you can be done.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And it's, at least speaking for me and reviewing the bill yesterday, it appeared clear that the insurance and continuing education requirements clearly met any bar that we might set. So my sense is it'll pass this committee. I appreciate your efforts with respect to, is it moxibustion?
Moxibustion was taken out.
And that your efforts to keep working down that path, and I appreciate the Asian bodywork concern. There is, I understand that there are going to be multiple additional committees and also in the Senate where this bill is going that have jurisdiction that is separate from insurance and continuing education like we have. So. With that, the chair will renew his motion and that House File 1503 be recommended to pass and referred to, to Government Operations as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Abler. The final bill we have this evening, folks, is mine.
Aye.
Thank you. I appreciate your support.
You know, I thought of doing it. Okay, we got it. I got it. Wait.
Mr. Chair and members, I will move the House File 2942 be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. There are several authors' amendments.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. We have your bill before us. Just wondering, is there any questions regarding these amendments before we get going? Because I kind of plan to move through them pretty quick, but if there's questions, I just kind of want to ask before we get flying on them. Looks like there isn't, so Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move all of the amendments as one at one time. They are the H-2942A2 amendment, the H-2942A3 amendment, the A-10-2232 amendment, the A-10-2211 amendment, the A-10-2167 amendment, the A-10-2229 amendment, the A-10-2209 amendment, and the A-10-2201 amendment. I feel comfortable doing that because you will find that you've been provided with a summary of each of the amendments in your materials. It was prepared by the Commerce Department. The A2 and A3 amendments were ones that were brought that have had no opposition from the department. With that, I would move those various amendments.
Okay. The chair has moved those amendments. To be clear that the A2 and A3 are not in the packet, so maybe you could just give them just a real brief...
Be happy to. The A3 amendment, working backwards, exempts group Medicare supplement policies from state law. It's been agreed to by the department, as I understand it. I am joined, by the way, by Manny Munson-Regala from the Department of Commerce in the event there's any questions. And the A2 amendment outlines a formula by which a member of the Minnesota Self-Insurers Security Fund may exit the fund. It's my understanding that they visited with some members, and we also have, if there's questions or concerns, we have a representative of that fund here to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you, Chair Atkins. Is there any questions to this? Is there Representative Davids?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins. What's the position of the Minnesota Association of Realtors on this bill?
Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Seems like we've
David.
Been here today once already.
So long as there's testing, they're okay with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no other questions, all those in favor of the amendments, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendments are adopted. Chair Atkins, we have your bill as amended before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the department bill as amended. I would stand for any questions that you may have. I'm certain that all of you have already read through the bill in its entirety as well as the amendments. So if there's any questions that you have, I'd just be happy to stand for them. Otherwise, I'd renew my motion.
Any questions for the author? Anybody interested in being heard for or against this bill? Seeing none, with that, the Chair Atkins. Please state your name for the record, and
yes.
Go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm...
Please keep it brief, because
yes.
my daughter's getting an award in a few minutes, and I'd like to see it.
I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers, and I'm also speaking on behalf of the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium. I just wanted to let the committee know that we are working with the department on another amendment that didn't get in time, so you have already heard the issue on another bill related to NeighborWorks America that was as far as created by an act of Congress. And you had the material in your brochure on the other bill. And so we're working with this particular thing. Now, I did have a chance to speak to the Assistant Secretary of HUD and the Board of Governor from the Federal Reserve, the chair of, or the head of NeighborWorks America in the program. And they are supportive as far as making changes, even at the national level, to kind of do some technical fixes to the issue. So just to let you know that that's forthcoming. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. I'm sorry to rush you. Any other questions? Any other comments? With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 2942 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Your bill is passed. Chair Atkins, do you want to give us a roadmap for Tuesday? Or
only for members to keep in mind, next week is deadline week, so we've got long agendas on Tuesday and Thursday. Liquor Day on Tuesday. Again, I'd remind you, if you have any local liquor bills to get in or any bottles of beer that you want to bring along to the committee, please do. With that, I'd move that we adjourn.
Second.